Well, good morning on March 20th, 2012 from San Francisco. This is Brian Madden, and you're listening to Brian and Gabe Live. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Gabe, how are you?
Not bad. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much. Sitting with me in the studio here in San Francisco is Jack.
Good morning, all.
And joining us via Skype from actually, I don't even know where you are, is Guys. How do you pronounce your last name or your first name?
Guy Buell.
Guy Buell.
You can call me Mr. Buell, Brian, right, if you like.
Guy Buell. So, and you're joining us now from?
I'm in London, but my heart's in San Francisco.
Oh, look at that. Well, it's actually good you're not here because someone took home the third microphone stand over the weekend and didn't bring it back. So it's good that you're calling in. And now, Guy, you're joining us as we have guests every week to sort of just join our chat about the industry. But I guess as a quick background on yourself, are you the founder, the CEO? You're related to?
I'm chief exec of Tuplad, also the founder. We are we're a platform agnostic virtual desktop cloud builder, but we are also a consultancy focused on desktop and application delivery. Anything to do with virtual desktop, really, Brian, that's what Tuplad do.
And so you tweeted yesterday, can we just go right on this?
I mean, why not have our record sixth show in a row pitching about Microsoft?
but yesterday, there is an article written about you, Guy, that was you want to start a new desktop as a service company that flagrantly, is that the right word? Like just very openly violates Microsoft's license policies because, hey, if OnLive is able to give a desktop for $5 a month with Office and break all licensing and not be sued like crazy, then why can't you?
Well, we're not going to do exactly like OnLive, Brian, because we you can't deliver a $10 desktop. It's impossible. To do so, you'd have to steal from Microsoft. We're not prepared to do that. You know, we're not. Think of the exercise as a proof of concept deployment. That's exactly what it's going to be. It can't be a real business because it's not based on legitimate Microsoft licensing regs. You know, it can't be a legitimate business. Licensing is a serious issue. You know this. If a CIO messes with Microsoft or, you know, toys with the licensing regs with their organization, people get sacked and sacked fast. It's a hot potato. So everyone tends to want to comply, meaning the business is going to have no real customers, but we'll get to have a lot of fun mounting a wonderful infrastructure, throwing desktops out there and beta testing the platform in preparation for the real time, you know, the big time, the real thing. It's going to be a lot of fun. It really is. We're looking forward to it.
Well, end users could buy it, right? And they don't care about getting sued by Microsoft.
Well, we don't really care about making money off this, actually. We'll probably give the desktops out for free, just like OnLive. And we'll announce the release of the 25-dollar desktop shortly, once we've conducted our beta testing. You know, just out of curiosity, OnLive haven't launched their $10 desktop, have they? It always says coming soon next to it. I don't think they have. It says coming soon next to it.
Was there a $5 one? This
morning.
Was there $5? I thought there was a $5 desktop.
I also think that's true. They're according to comments, at least, there was a pay for version was released. So I'm not sure. Let's look at the website here. The beauty of having the internet. They have a $4.99 a month plan that also gives you a browser, and that's about it. So $5 a month gets you a browser on top of the free edition that has no browser.
Okay, and then the $10 one.
The $10 a month one is coming soon, which, guys, apparently in the article that Bridget Botello wrote, she said that you were going to offer a $10 desktop at desktopsondemand.com. So we did intend to,
but then the thought occurred to us that you can't do a $10 desktop. It's not possible. If we wanted to go out and actually physically buy one retail copy of Windows 7 for each individual user we sell a desktop to, that, you know, you still can't do it at $10, even if you amortize it out over a year.
But you can do
it
with the hardware. The hardware can do it. You just have to steal Windows.
Sure.
I think you
can't do it. You've got to steal Windows, and we're not going to do that. We're not going to.
But why not?
You don't say how often you charge them $10 either. It could be per month. It could be per week.
$10
per
hour.
$2.99.
Yeah,
$2.99.
Websites 1-900 desktops.
$10 a minute.
So the So online, okay. So I mean, I know this is, you know, we won't spend the whole show on this, but just I'm, you know, collecting opinions on this. Like, so your opinion is that OnLive is, well, I guess not in compliance.
Well, you know, we've both tried to talk to OnLive, and in fact, I have been for the last over the last good few months, going back 8 months, speaking to people within the organization, engaged with them on a couple of opportunities till they withdrew, citing lack of resources. But I've been chatting to these guys on and off for months, and just like you, Brian, they told me nothing, absolutely nothing. You know, I had my questions the same as you. But this overriding sense of absolutely no concern about Microsoft licensing whatsoever was the single biggest feeling I took away from my conversations with them. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know how they're doing it. I don't know what their conversations with Microsoft are, but I sense from every single person I spoke to in that organization, they don't care. They've got no concerns. It's like they've been given a wink and a nudge, and I don't know. But, you know, you'd be concerned if you were them right now. No? Yeah, I'd be concerned. But
well,
then again,
Well, so last week we were talking it was a little bit conspiracy theory-esque, but we were talking, you know, the possibilities that there are background arrangements going on and such, and maybe an acquisition target or something like that.
Anything's possible. Anything's possible.
And I guess if that's the case, they wouldn't be afraid.
Well, that would certainly make sense. That line of argument, Brian, you know, that'd make sense. I'm choosing not to focus on conspiracy theories or what OnLive are doing. I'm much more focused on getting the model we've kind of chosen as a business out there, this non-persistent virtual desktop platform that you just can't do with server slices. You know, OnLive are happy to run their business any way they choose, but we have a very specific model that collides directly with Microsoft licensing regs. So we have our own gripes about them. I'm sure OnLive have theirs, but for different reasons, Brian. You know, I happen to think OnLive's non-persistent desktops are sweet. It's the future of the hosted virtual desktop, that lack of persistency, for lots of different reasons. But I happen to really like what they're doing with their platform. They've got an awesome setup there. It really is a cloud DC wet dream they've got going on over there. You know, it really is. I wish I could afford to buy them. I do. I would.
So what does 2Cloud do that's different than OnLive? I don't know too much about 2Cloud. And, since you're here, like, we'll give you a couple minutes. This point in the show is not to be commercial for 2Cloud, but I don't...
Sure. No, I won't be. 2Cloud operate in a very specific niche. We build private desktop clouds. Full stop. Private desktop clouds, and offer professional services around those private desktop clouds, focused on app and desktop delivery. We only deal with companies that have software assurance in place exclusively. We don't deal with any other part of the market. We're not allowed to. It's a happy niche. We're seeing great traction within this niche and the model we've kind of propagated. We were the first to kind of really put the non-persistent hosted virtual desktop model into operation in any, you know, any size. We co-developed that model in collaboration with the Advanced Computing team over at the National Nuclear Security Agency, Lawrence Livermore. And it's our baby, this non-persistent virtual desktop model. It's one that's resonating with every single customer we speak to. It just so happens the model collides with Microsoft licensing, and it's a shame. It really, really is.
The non-persistent collides with Microsoft licensing, but in your case, all your customers have SA, so it doesn't, like, that's
exactly
how you make it not collide.
It doesn't bother us. It doesn't bother us at all. However, why can I not sell, you know, $25 desktops through an automated payment portal like GoDaddy sells domains? I've got the platform built almost. Why can I not sell them just like OnLive's doing it? That's what I'd like to know.
Yeah.
Because if I could, I would, and people would buy them.
So how did you crack the non-persistent? You mentioned Lawrence Livermore, something about nuclear. Is that what, I mean,
yeah, we,
do you
we,
use a layering we, from like a Unidesk or something like that? Did you build your own, or is it?
No, because the desktop requirement is what we call low-hanging fruit. They're non-persistent desktops running browsers. The only persistency on the desktop front is things like browser plugins, you know, kind of browser bookmarks, and all focused around the browser. It's folder redirection, right? There's no complicated layering in the model, which is why it's a beautiful model. It's just a desktop clean with a browser or three browsers to mitigate the risk into. You know, you handle all of your forward-facing internet activity on that one desktop. And the reason we kind of brought this product to market was at the demand of a customer, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. They had a problem with attacks. I mean, every single major organization in the U.S. and globally has been attacked, cyber attacked over the last 2 years. We read about it, and what we read about really is the tip of the iceberg. Well, you know, by lots of state and non-state operators, it seems the trend emerging is, you know, anybody who doesn't control intellectual property has realized it's remarkably easy to go and steal that intellectual property from those that do.
See,
you know, why invest in R&D? You know, why invest in R&D?
It's more and you it's, get better ROI in hacking and stealing it than you do actually developing it.
Hell yeah, and that's affecting everyone. It's not just big business, but small business too. You know, and the same applies to anything of value, be it your financial details, your personal banking information, straight the way through to your customer book and all of their CC details. It goes on and it goes on and it goes on, and you have to begin to shut down hatches. And the interesting thing is that 95% of these attacks are in the form of the advanced persistent threat. They attack the individual user through their persistent desktop running Windows OSs over the internet. Over the open internet, because that user's going about their daily business, which these days involves social networking, webmail, you know, and the whole shebang. And really, the only way to protect against these attacks is to shut that desktop down, you know, close down internet access completely to all of your users within your organization. But then you get pushback. I mean, can you imagine being sat at a desk in front of a computer with no internet? It'd be a miserable existence. And they open up internet access over time, but with a bit more security, and boom, they get hit again. It's a reactive response to cybersecurity threats. So with a non-persistent hosted virtual desktop hosted outside of your DCs and your critical infrastructure and away from your IP, it makes perfect sense. You give all your users a nice, you know, non-persistent hosted virtual desktop. Let them do all the risky stuff on that. When they're finished with it, at the end of their session, they log out, the desktop's destroyed. And none of that open internet touches the internal infrastructure. If you think of it, it's the perfect application of VDI.
That's exactly what I thought in 1998 when we called it MetaFrame.
I'm calling it the non-persistent desktop model of the future. In my mind,
doing it with VDI instead of with remote desktop session host?
We're a desktop virtualization company, Brian. We deal in desktop virtualization technologies. We're not just a VDI shop.
We also have hammers.
You know, we also focus on the client side. We can run non-persistent desktops on a client side on a laptop using NXTOP virtual computers, and we do. It's a wonderful way of achieving exactly the same end. Multiple desktops you can hotkey between, one for online banking, one for porn, and the other one for work. You know, and
that's why I have three browsers. You don't need three whole desktops.
But it's not really. Yes, you do. If you're really going to take it securely, seriously, you need three individual VMs and isolate that risk out properly.
And you partner with a virtual computer for NXTOP for the client based stuff.
So yeah, you have a laptop with NXTOP on it. You can hotkey between three, you know, Windows XP desktop for work or Windows 7 desktop for personal use, and then one for online banking or whatever. Mm. You know, dedicated to that purpose. You can have a desktop for every task if you really want to be paranoid about your security. And if they're non-persistent threats, malware threats don't hold, you know, between sessions, it's a wonderful way of mitigating against any kind of cyber attack and malware. Because let's be honest, you know, client endpoint security is a running joke, right? I mean, are we protecting our users? Are botnets not proliferating? Are we not hemorrhaging financial details and IP out of our economies? You could say this problem, and I will say it, affects the prosperity of the Western world, guys. We need to be able to start shutting down hatches. And the way to do this is to use VDI in this non-persistent fashion and give people more than one desktop.
But so again, why VDI instead of terminal server?
Because terminal servers, I see it as a step backwards, terminal server. For a start, isn't it a technology that's decades old, designed to let admins log into a server? And I just don't get why you'd want to expose users to that kind of risk. Why would you want to step away from the idea of multiple desktops in multiple VMs, which from a cybersec or security perspective makes a lot of sense, back to a model where you're sharing server images? And here's the problem I have with the terminal server hosted virtual desktop space. They're lying to their customers. They're telling them they're Windows 7 desktops. Their sales guys sell them as desktops, but they're not. They're slices of server that you're sharing with other users. One user gets hit, every user on that server image gets hit. And there's no persistency. They're persistent desktops. There's no non-persistency in that equation, and typically with most hosted virtual desktop, all hosted virtual desktop offerings out there. And the thinking behind that, Brian, is that it's easy to kind of migrate a traditional persistent desktop user across to a persistent, you know, server slice, skin to look like Windows 7. And it is. But why would you do that when you have non-persistent desktop virtualization models that can handle this kind of, you know, thing much more efficiently? It's just a better, more beautiful, more elegant model.
But don't you just said that the terminal server approach is non-persistent? I'm sorry, is persistent? I'm sorry.
Our argument is that it is
non-persistent. It's the best non-persistent solution.
You're saying terminal services?
Yes. I mean, we're saying that is the original non-persistent solution, that we've been doing non-persistent for several years.
But it's not being done. It's not being done. If you go out there into the hosted virtual desktop market and pick any terminal server house that sells what they call desktops, be it, you know, Vesk on the NetOffice or you know, any of them, they're all selling persistent desktop images with persistent applications running on that desktop. And the persistence, you know, It exists from between sessions. It's not a non-persistent equation. They're not thinking in non-persistent terms. It's not being done. You're talking about it because you guys know about the desktop space and the way to flip a virtual desktop, but these guys don't.
But we're talking about it because we've been doing it for 13 years, and we've both delivered thousands and thousands of seats that are non-persistent terminal server-based seats. And we've been doing that in a successful way as an industry for a very long time. So maybe not in a hosted capacity, but definitely within our organizations, people use this stuff in a non-persistent way all the time. And there's in some ways they're deploying desktops, in some ways they're deploying seamless applications. But in very, very few circumstances is anybody really trying to sell that this is a copy. You know, this is Windows 7. And we can skin it, we can make it look like it, but I don't think anybody's saying, hey, this is the exact same desktop you have at home. We're just trying to
make it look
a little bit better.
That's what he's saying.
Yeah, well, so I think this is what Guy is saying is about the hosted companies are going out and selling a Windows 7 desktop, even though it's terminal server. And I agree
that could be.
With what Ron says in the comments, which I agree also, which is I think more than in this aspect of the terminal server versus VDI, it seems like Guy's point is around the security, the fact that a VM isolation around a user is more secure.
It's all about security.
And you know, I've done this terminal server versus VDI conversation. Well, we've been doing it, talking about this for 6 years now. And last week when I was in Phoenix, I had that conversation again. And this is sort of part of that. My question, and I come to this truly not knowing the answer. Maybe someone in the chat room knows this. So, Guy, you mentioned the security risk. Which I am conceptually on board with. My question is, do you know of documented cases of when there was some kind of security breach from like one user surfing the internet, for example, within a terminal server session, and that affected the integrity of the entire terminal server? And
Yes, I do. I know from, excuse me, previous conversations, Brian. Just want to preface it with, I'm not a technical man. I'm the song and dance guy.
Yeah.
I'm the chief exec. Excuse me, but I've had lots and lots of conversations with Israelis, specifically the Israeli Cyber Defense Institute. We are collaborating with them to build these next-gen VDI platforms with layers of tech wrapped around them, be it deep packets inspection, deep content inspection, intrusion detection. And the general consensus is within Israeli circles, bearing in mind this is the most attacked nation on Earth, that you need that absolute separation of desktops. You need these non-persistent virtual machines, and that terminal server based platforms are less secure. That's the general consensus I'm getting. It's accepted that VDI is the way forward if you're going to talk about deploying desktops to users that are going to use them as desktops. It has to be the non-persistent VDI model. That's the demand we're getting from customers. Nobody's asking for terminal services. Nobody wants terminal services outside of small businesses who don't know any better.
They because it's a cost play. Yeah, and frankly, and to the anonymous person who asked about, you know, documented examples, I'm curious on this myself, and so I will commit to sort of take this as an action item, which I'll probably assign to Jack. I mean, let's dig. I'm not a security guy either, so I don't know.
I'll be happy to bring in a chap called Joey Peleg. We're going to begin a series of conversations around this exact subject over the next month and a half. But I'm sure he'd be happy to join us in conversations to talk specifically about the technical security aspects of a terminal server platform compared to a VDI platform. These guys are more focused on things like identity access management, intrusion detection, deep packet, deep content inspection. They will be able to answer these specific security-related questions about the two different platforms in more detail. I'm happy to coordinate that conversation with you. I leave this conversation to my CTO and COO, Tom and Matt, right? I mean, like I said, I'm the song and dance guy, Brian. But it's certainly a conversation that's worth having more of. We intend to over the next month and a half.
I'm surprised VMware hasn't played that up, because VMware looks like, I would have been surprised over the past 5 years they didn't really play up that angle. They always sort of looked at the incompatibilities, you know, the application incompatibilities with terminal server and things like that. So since all they have is a VDI solution when it comes to desktops in the data center. So they have a lot of smart people. Maybe they're listening now and they can go do some digging on this too. I'm just curious overall. And, you know, I think I've said this in the past, but my long-term vision is that absolutely, VDI is going to sort of the cost differentials between terminal server and VDI are getting, you know, as the costs go down and down and down and down and down. It might be still 3x difference, but that 3x is measured in like single dollars per user at some point. It doesn't almost matter. And the other advantages of having VDI, you know, it's the same OS you have for your desktops, your physical desktops, your client VMs, same level of application compatibility. You can have fully persistent desktops, whether it's a layered solution or just good old-fashioned persistent. I definitely believe there's a lot of advantages that VDI has over terminal server, and terminal server primarily has been a cost thing. But that's kind of why I always thought, though, that hosters were going after terminal server hosting, because it seems to me, and I'm not a hoster either, so I don't know how this works, but it seems that the model is rack them and stack them, make them as cheap as possible, and sell as many as you can. And that's
exactly
where I was thinking that terminal server was their sweet spot.
Exactly so. It's down to density, and that's the reason you have as many users as possible crammed onto the same persistent server image. It's a recipe for cyber attack disaster. It really is. They're building their platforms is wrong.
Yeah. And you're saying that the server image is persistent then. And that, I mean, obviously that can be done in a non-persistent way, but in most situations, the server image itself is persistent. The user session is not,
what I'm seeing, absolutely, non-persistency is kind of like this new novel idea that people talk about, but nobody really does, still in the virtual desktop space. Nobody really talks about non-persistency on the desktop front other than you guys. You give a traditional persistent desktop user a slice of a server that's persistent with all the apps on it, with Office on it, and they'll use it just like they use it, you know, use a normal desktop. They don't really see any difference, and neither do the people behind these platforms. They kind of rack them and stack them and squeeze as many as they can onto a server, and it's just got no security in mind. It's not. It's a cost-driven, you know, model. Plus, it's legit licensing, right? What else can you do?
So one of the commenters is asking to elaborate on the cyber attack disaster, and if I may elaborate, and Guy, you tell me if I understand this properly. The cyber attack disaster with terminal server primarily is the fact that if one user session is compromised, all of the users could be compromised, and because the terminal server itself is not sort of blown away.
There's
no isolation, which means it could other user sessions could be compromised. But then when a new user logs on, they're logging onto a compromised system. Whereas with VDI, you have got the isolation since you're separate VM, so a compromised VM does not affect other users. But B, when the user logs off, it's blown away, and that same user logging on again is getting a new snapshot from the original locked gold master. So the compromise
exactly so.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, it's twofold.
That's the gist of it. Yeah, that's the gist of it. You know, it depends on how the infrastructure is built, of course, but that's how typically they're built out there.
Yeah.
These people aren't security people. They've just seen a way of building desktops in a legal manner, and the demand's increasing for hosted virtual desktops. I turn down 70% of my leads. I know they go somewhere else. They go to the TS guys.
And turning down the leads because
because they don't have software assurance in place.
Mm.
So you know, you Google host a virtual desktop, two clouds number one. I get a lot of leads pass through my hands. We qualify them all, and if they're too small, we pass them, and we pass them to our partners. What other option do we have? We can't handle them ourselves. It's another conversation, Brian. But yeah, that's how things are being built out there.
I'm Googling hosted virtual desktop. Oh, look at you! You are number one. I did it with an incognito window also, so it's actually legitimate results.
And you're good job picking Gartner's term for VDI.
Yeah, right. Unfortunately, no one calls it that, but but those who do, they're going to find you. And you're ahead
70% of the leads that pass through my hands, I cannot handle because I refuse to touch anything that's not true desktop virtualization. I just don't want to.
It's not true.
I'm a desktop vert guy.
And you define desktop vert as VDI.
VDI, yeah.
No, not necessarily anything that specifically handles a desktop OS in a virtual format.
Desktop
could be
OS.
Client side. You know, I'm a huge fan of virtual computers, NXTOP, and you can do exactly the same thing with non-persistency on the client using NXTOP. This isn't just a VDI conversation. It's the security conversation. It's about deploying multiple desktops to mitigate risk into each of them, to protect yourself proactively in a way you can't with any other kind of solution. It really is.
Is this something that is just going to change like psyche? Because like I'm sure when condoms were first invented, well, that's probably 200 years ago, but I don't know, like in the 60s, I don't know. I'm talking out my ass right now, but I mean like, you know, in the old days, like before AIDS and stuff, people were not really down on condoms and because it's like, oh, I who cares and everything. And then when people started realizing they had to protect themselves, it just became kind of fine, and there's a bunch of years where it was tough, and then it's just kind of like standard nowadays. Or maybe I could say like drunk driving also. Like before MAD got involved, people didn't really care about drunk driving, and now it's just, hey, we recognize we have designated drivers and that kind of stuff. So I wonder if we're in the early stages of now that people are like, hey, we have to use multiple virtual desktops to protect ourselves and different, you want like your serious banking transactions in one desktop, your porn in another desktop, and your work in a third one, and everything else in a fourth one.
Yeah, just from another aspect, as a question popped up, guys yapping for publicity, not as a viable infrastructure architect. Let me throw a use case out for you if you want to talk about infrastructure and the cost efficiencies behind using the non-persistent virtual desktop model to serve many more named users than you have concurrently running desktops. And the extreme end of this is our customer UCLA. We're serving desktops to 70,000 students. Each of those students have their own named desktop, their own bookmarks, their own kind of little persistent user profile, let's call it. How many concurrently running desktops do you think we run at peak to deliver desktops to that many users? Have a guess, Brian. What do you think?
If it's students, I don't know. I guess if you have 70,000 named students, you have 69,000 logged on between like midnight and 3 a.m. before finals.
Well, no, these desktops are delivered through the library service. So in the libraries, scattered throughout the campus, these, I think it's 15 or 16 libraries, there are banks of terminals running clients that we throw desktops at. The answer is 250 concurrently running desktops. We're serving 70,000 named users with just 250 concurrently running desktops. If you kind of consider the infrastructure savings behind that model compared to any other on the market, it just makes sense from an infra perspective. It really, really does. Nothing can touch it. And this is the model that's resonating with any organization that has multiple users spread across different time zones that only needs to use a resource at a certain time. The non-persistent model allows that. Because, you know, if someone's not using the desktop, it's destroyed. It's resources returned for use by others. It's an elegant model.
And in your case, you don't even have to do any fancy user personalization. You're just talking kind of basic user profile stuff.
Well, we can do. We can layer application layers on top of that and use a virtual. It depends on the requirement. Because remember, we're building private cloud to spec. We can't do multi-tenancy. If I could build a national US multi-tenant infrastructure, you know, the cost efficiencies involved in named users to concurrent desktops running would be really impressive. You know, you could do something wonderful there. You could flip desktops all around the US and only have half the amount of concurrence you actually need at any given time. It's you could do something really nice there. On Live are kind of reaching at that a little bit now. They're saying gamers game during the day, and sorry, people work during the day on desktops, and gamers game at night. So they've got all these kind of resources sitting there doing nothing. It's the same concept. You need the multi-tenancy to get the cost efficiency, to get, you know, the true efficiency behind the non-persistent model. Without, you know, multi-tenancy, the model's restricted to use within private clouds. And
for those listening, I guess probably most people are familiar, but the quick recap is, even in your case, so you're only talking to customers who have SA, which means they're allowed to have their Windows
exactly.
desktops from you. But even if, as a provider, multi-tenancy, it's describing you're not allowed to have two VMs from the same from different customers on the same physical server. Right?
Correct.
Does that go beyond server? I mean, can you store the VMs on the same storage?
There's interesting ways of approaching the problem.
But even like blades, what if you're in the same box but different circuit boards? But then like what if you're in a different core? What if you're in different memory? That's so crazy.
Like, you can get creative for sure. I mean, we don't really touch blades.
What's your personal take on why Microsoft does not allow multi-tenancy? Like, what possible plausible reason would they have for forcing you to like overbuild your environment essentially with all this waste?
I have no idea. It could only exist as a break against the growth and development of a market. Mm. I have no idea why else they put that no multi-tenancy rule right in the middle of their EULA. I have no idea why they do that beyond wanting to break a space.
It's interesting because they, you know, they're so smug about being green. They're like people who drive Priuses, and they're just like all the silverware at campus is compostable, and they're all like eco whatever. And then because of that stupid rule, they're making people have all these extra services burning coal all day long, because I got two users from two customers and I got full servers running for them. So like I think they cancel out like that one line in that one in that license agreement cancels out, you know, like
their solar panels or whatever.
Yeah, like all the solar panels in Redmond are canceled out by that one line.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, in a private desktop cloud situation, if it's not being used, it's sitting idle, the resource. It's doing nothing. You're exactly right.
Would there be a large market? We emailed a little bit. I wrote an article a few weeks ago about, it was right after we had Claudio on, about how the lack of a SPLA means that small businesses that may want to take advantage of this are priced out, or it's just not practical for a hosted provider like yourself to provide desktops for less than, say, 50 users. So these small 10, 15, 20 user companies are just, they can't even approach a solution like this because there's no multi-tenancy. Do you think that there is a business out there or a market out there for small numbers, 10 people, 20 people?
Absolutely.
That kind of thing?
It's the bulk of the market. Where are the most desktop users? I mean, outside of the enterprise, they're small in the small business. They're in the small to medium sized business market or personal desktop space. I mean, we are flooded with leads. I speak to every other chief exec in the hosted desktop space, apart from the ones that don't like me. And they're all telling me the same thing. We're flooded with leads. The ones that I can't handle flow through to the terminal server guys. I on a personal note, I find it disgusting that, you know, Microsoft in principle agree with the idea of the hosted virtual desktop enough to let terminal server providers ply their desktops between brackets. But I'm not allowed to do it with a proper Windows 7 OS that's licensed. Nuts.
Rick in the chat room says that Microsoft is obviously protecting its ELA revenue, the enterprise license agreement stuff. And I would just have to think that from a small business perspective, those guys don't have ELAs anyway. So they're not protecting anything. They're just making it harder on people.
They're making it harder on people. They're basically saying, if you give us a lot of money, we aren't going to tell you what you can and can't do with our desktops. You can do, the hosted virtual desktops are free if you have software assurance in place. You just have to report the usage in most cases. You know, speaking generally, you just have to report usage. There is no cost, Microsoft licensing cost, for those infrastructures. Think of that. And then you kind of compare that to the small market, the small business end of the space, where guys are buying 10 or 15 desktops for their business. You know, companies that could really benefit, incidentally, from outsourcing management of their desktops and IT infrastructure to someone who can do it best, they're not being allowed to enjoy the same benefits. They're really not. Even if they go the TS route, they're paying much more in licensing per desktop user than people with software assurance ever do.
Hey, in the chat room, I'm reading this from across the room, but it says they're protecting their OEMs, is the comment. Can you expand on that? Or to those
no,
on the phone? What would that mean?
I don't know. I don't deal with OEMs. I deal with virtual desktops, not ones that are locked to a physical machine.
Well, so in that regard, I'm guessing that just means they're protecting Dell and HP and those guys. You know, the people that right now are the primary source of desktops for small businesses or for any business, really. So they're protecting those guys, their business, because otherwise, you know, if you're virtualizing these things, you're not buying boxes from Dell.
It's... I think it's a bigger conversation than this, though, guys. It's not just about the kind of desktops users should be able to use or shouldn't be able to use. It's about giving them multiple desktops to mitigate risk. We need to take this problem of security much more seriously than we are. And the non-persistent VDI model, you know, kind of cushioned with other techs around it, is a valid way of dealing with security threats on a personal or corporate level for any size business. It works. It really does work. And it's not about the kind of desktop a user should have. We want to give them 3 or 4 desktops or 5 desktops and bring the cost down to a point where it's, you know, affordable to do so, to leverage and have that kind of protection against attacks and against malware and against all the nasties that will suck all your personal information off your computer and sell it. It's a viable model of fighting proactively these kind of attacks. And we need to start bolting down the hatches. Now, I see this model being picked up in major defense contractors, governments, federal agencies. We're working this space, remember. We know this non-persistent virtual desktop model is being picked up and deployed globally by those with IP to protect. But typically, these companies have software assurance in place. Smaller companies don't have the resource to even know about this subject, let alone, you know, deal with cyber attacks. They just want to run their businesses.
So are you going to give...
I was going to say the multiple virtual machine for security perspective, that makes a lot of sense in government, high finance, that kind of a thing. But by and large, across all users everywhere, people don't want to know that they've got different machines running. Right?
But people... do you agree the idea, though, that this desktop's for nothing but online banking and pay, you know, your financial affairs, maybe it's online trading platform. You use it for those two tasks and those two tasks alone, and you know it's secure for that reason. You've contained the risk. You're only accessing 2 key websites, and then another desktop for general web browsing and all the kind of internet-facing stuff that you're being told is risky. You'd use 2 different desktops if they were cost-effective enough. You'd have 3 or 4.
That's true, you know. But I guess my point, though, is that that is a niche of a niche. And so we're getting very specialized at that point. We're not talking about the task workers out there that also can benefit from some of this types of technology, but don't need to know, don't want to know, can't handle the fact that stuff is coming from multiple locations and multiple desktops on a single machine. So ideally, you know, we have the high security solutions, but we also have the other solutions that are just kind of, you know, the low hanging fruit of the.
For everyone else, let's give them a non-persistent desktop with layers of persistent apps and user persona on it and tell them it's a terminal server desktop. Tell them it's a desktop. You know, it's let me sell them in an automated fashion in the way the TS guys can. That's all I want to do, modify the rigs we have got to serve the small business market.
That's how it pretty much is right now. I mean, those large VDI deployments that you hear about, they aren't as prevalent, I think, as you're led to believe. Now, I know that you're involved with some, Citrix says they are, VMware says they are, and they exist. I'm not disputing that, but they are not, you know, as prevalent as you might think, or as we're led to believe. And if you ask the consultants out there, I've asked a lot of people what the largest VDI deployment they've worked on is, and nobody has said over 1,000. And in most organizations, it's still just a terminal server-based desktop.
Well, you guys know the desktop space, right? You guys know everybody in the desktop space. I do. It's such a small space. We can count on one hand the number of guys that have deployed over 10,000 desktops twice.
Yeah.
Twice. Okay, so a few steps back, and I'll get to the couple of questions in the chat room in a second. Okay, so first of all, just educate me. Like, I'm not a security conscious person, maybe. I don't know. But, like, what is the, like, why do I need a separate VM for banking? What's the risk?
Let's talk about the corporate use case for non-persistent, which is the experience I can speak to, because we're dealing with customers that have software assurance in place. The mitigation of risk is that, say you're a financial institution, your local native desktops are running, you know, whatever applications are specific to your financial service industry. You lock down internet access to those desktops completely, but just give them a second non-persistent hosted virtual desktop to conduct all of the internet-facing activities your users need to do to keep in touch with friends, family, loved ones, colleagues. And that environment is completely separate to your internal infrastructure, which can't, you know, information cannot pass between that hosted virtual non-persistent desktop and the local machine. Furthermore, you've got a SEC team in the DC who've wrapped intrusion detection, who've wrapped deep packet, deep content inspection around that non-persistent platform, giving you 360 battle space awareness. So when attacks occur, you know where they're going to attack in your infrastructure because you've parceled off the risk and isolated it to a specific, you know, specific dedicated infrastructure, and you're in a better position to deal with it when you are attacked because you have the technologies in place to identify an attack and deal with it in real time. If you have the SEC guys in the DC, which if you're building a SEC infrastructure for that purpose, you will have. That's the use case.
Do I need Windows to do this? I mean, I guess I've got Windows applications, and if I have any applications, I need Windows and then Windows licensing. But like for the VM, like Chrome is Chrome, right?
Well, we need we need HDX, and you know, HDX doesn't work with Linux desktops. I favor Windows 7 desktops with HDX pushing out over the WAN. I'm a huge fan of HDX. I mean, that the desktop platform runs HDX. So did Caviezo. I mean, it's just what we've kind of standardized on, and it works. It works. It really does.
And
it's
so wonderful. For what you do at 2Cloud, so it's almost like you're almost like an MSP kind of. I mean, it's sort of custom built private cloud. So
custom built private cloud.
You personally
nominal ownership. Well, we don't own those infrastructures. Right. The client owns those infrastructures. Right. We provide a service, professional services around that platform. We build it, architects it, design it, deploy it, run it, manage it, provide technical support around it to its users. But it's not our platform. It's the customer's platform. They extend their licensing across to that platform. It's a well-trodden path. It's the game desktop play. They're in the same space as we are.
So a couple of questions have been about this non-persistent, if non-persistent is a future. And then people are asking about what about users with different apps, you know, printers, plugins, all that kind of stuff. So what's the approach for sort of capturing that in a non-persistent desktop?
Depends. I mean, these kind of questions, if you're deploying an infrastructure for CyberSec purposes to mitigate against attacks, then, you know, printers are easy to connect and all that kind of good stuff. You know, Citrix has lots of different little techs that connect printers and USB peripherals and all that good stuff. We never have an issue with that. But they're not being used, these desktops. Remember, they're being used to mitigate against cyber attacks and to enhance your cybersecurity posture as an organization. They're not being used to do day-to-day work. They're being used for internet-facing activity, social networking, webmail, LinkedIn, whatever it may be, WebExes. They're allowing you to completely lock down your internal infrastructure and your internal desktops, where you do all the good stuff day to day to make a living.
And then for the users who want to install stuff, do they have another desktop somewhere else? Or does the fact that users have iPads and iPhones now...
Users can't install. Yeah, I mean, in our environments, users can't install applications. I mean, they typically work through Landesk or something. You know, there's typically some way, sanctioned way, that users can get access to applications and have those installed. We deal with tightly regulated industries and high security environments, so it's not the norm, Brian. But typically, users can't install their own apps on our desktops. But if the client requirement demands it, then why not? You know, there's all kinds of cool stuff you can do, installing persistent app layers on top of non-persistent desktops, using things like AppSense. You know, there's all kind of cool techs. Liquidware Labs have got their own ways that they're kind of coming up with to achieve the same goal, which is the illusion of persistency whilst using non-persistent desktops.
Yeah, and we had Ron on, was it last week or 2 weeks ago? I mean, I know the layering has come a long way also, and just in general, and AppSense and Res and all those folks are doing things. And to the comment about IT managing two desktops for every user, I guess that's not the case, though, because if these are non-persistent desktops, then...
There's no management. Do you know, we run thousands of these to tens of thousands of users. Do you know what 99% of the support tickets are about? Password changes. they're non-persistent. Nothing breaks on them. They're session-based desktops. They just run, and all you do is focus on intrusion detection and making sure that infrastructure is safe. You know, it's 99%. See, one of the Don with VDI is calling me ignorant, but I run tens of thousands of hosted virtual desktops that are non-persistent. 95% of our tech support inquiries from users are about password changes. I can tell you that from experience, and I'm running more of these desktops than anyone else on earth. So consider me the subject matter expert on this, Don. you know, nothing much goes wrong. Of course, they require patching and updating, but we do that. We don't bother the customers with it. You know, that's all done behind the scenes by my sys engineers. It's you know, why do I need to talk to customers about patching and OS updating? I don't. They want a clean environment they can mitigate risk into.
Okay, so we've got 45 minutes into the conversation. Let's kind of hit up some other news type things that happened this week and take our last 15 minutes and just sort of move on for other topics. I don't know what I haven't. So my week this past week has been still focusing on this book, which is done writing, but we were doing layouts and all the final changes and stuff. But that book is now off to the printer. So our book, The VDI Delusion, it ought to be in Amazon very soon. I'm hoping today. I'm just got to figure out how to make the table contents work right in the Kindle version. And I think once we send it to Amazon, it's available in a day or two. So I'm hoping it's like very, very soon available to get that.
Yeah, if you haven't noticed it, Brian hasn't written anything in like, I don't know, 20 days or something like that on BrianMadden.com. It's because there's a book. So he's been the primary writer for one 60,000 word article.
And hell of an article. Like, usually we don't even proofread articles. Well, I don't. I don't know about you guys. But
no, not really.
It's the web. We edit it tomorrow and then it's a problem.
Yeah, we edit it. Yeah, on the fly.
So the other kind of things that happen. So I noticed also, so there's a job posting on, so VMware is looking for a senior director of product marketing for Horizon. And so I don't know if that's Noah's job, but if you look at it, the senior director is going to have a bunch of PMMs reporting to this person. They want someone with like, you know, MBA and like 10 years of experience and be the primary interface to talk about Horizon in front of analysts and the press and the media and have like thought leadership and the product line leadership and everything. So I don't know if that means that Horizon is like on pause until they hire this person, like now that Noah has left. I haven't spoken with Noah actually since he left and is now at Mobile Iron. But I guess if there's anyone who... you know, thinks that VMware is awesome and Horizon is awesome and wants a cool job, it's available.
Yeah, that's too bad if it is postponed, just because there was so much promise to it. But I guess, you know, as long as they get something done and something shiny between now and, September 1st.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they'll get, like, the rest of the team's still there, so they'll press on. And maybe this is one of those jobs that they have to post. Maybe they have an internal candidate or something like that. The other thing, so Justin sent this article today about VMware
WSX. Yeah, yeah. Have you heard of this before?
No, but I was looking
at me either,
Twitter.
So I feel better now.
Hang on a second, let me make some noise here. All right,
what the hell was that?
It's this microphone stand. So WSX, the article made it look like it was an App Blast. It was HTML5. Client for Windows desktops and applications. It works natively on Safari and the iPad and these other browsers with no plugins. And I tweeted that, oh, I guess WSX is the new name for, or is the production name for App Blast, which is cool actually, because remember there was ESX and GSX back in the day, so I guess WSX is like Workstation SX. But the people posted that's actually not the same thing. And I actually can't find it this exact second. I don't know
So the gist of this thing though is that it runs with runs on VMware Workstation for Linux and allows you its HTML5 access to that desktop, that specific desktop. So it's, I don't know if it's App Blast. That's what I first thought.
Well, it's not.
So that's what I went into and looked. So I don't know where this thing fits in or why. I'm surprised that we didn't hear of it until today, you know, that it came out in Wired before. Usually things hit Wired a month after they got popular, you know?
It's annoying too, because they talk about how like VMware cracked this code, and I feel bad for companies like Ericom and like Install Free who did this stuff, you know, for the past year. And it's like Rodney Dangerfield, you know, like can't get no respect. And then VMware does it. And then Wired is all like, they've cracked the code and they have this.
Yeah,
this
HTML5 access to Linux-based VMware workstation Windows virtual machines.
You know, I think somebody over at Wired just might have like a friend that works at VMware or something, because it seems like over the last couple of weeks there have been like three or four articles in Wired mentioning VMware that I've never seen that happen before.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It came out today, so I don't know if maybe they just, you know, there was a leak through to certain websites, because Wired had it. And it looks like Engadget has it. And I think that Wired article mentioned ours or was in some sort of partnership with Ars Technica. So I feel like this is some sort of coordinated assault on the consumer, you know, press.
Well, this is the same people who love who loved OnLive, like the same OnLive thing, you know?
Yeah, these are the same people that said, oh my God, how can OnLive be in violation of Microsoft?
Oh like, God, those people that, yeah, there's nothing funnier than watching.
it was like teenage high school drama.
Yeah, which, you know, we do, we play our part in that world too, but we at least do it on different stuff. That, I mean, it's just all these consumer things that, when the consumers start writing about our area, and I don't know if like this is just me being an asshole, but you know, I'm definitely this, like, they're writing about our area and they don't know what they're talking about at all.
Jackasses.
Yeah, because it happens. I mean, all the OnLive stuff, half the articles about OnLive were wrong or misleading, and then this stuff too. I feel bad. Like I said, if I'm Ericom or Install Free or someone, I'm pissed at this, because it's like, we've been doing that for a year and a half now and nothing. And then VMware does it.
Oh, right, yeah. If you're a desktop provider.
Right.
You know, it's kind of, you're just not impressed by it. And you're right about the articles kind of being skewed by journalists' understanding of the space. It's why, you know, Guy Buell challenges Microsoft, you know, baits them to sue him, is screaming across the internet right now.
Well, but that's just good headlines. I can't argue with that.
It's great headlines.
I'll respect that. And the thing is,
that's exactly what the focus on.
Yeah, and it's funny because people accused you, Guy, of only, you know, being like self-promoting, like only doing it for it's a publicity stunt, you know, retweeted by 246 people.
I've been screaming for a year about this. You know, this isn't a new subject for me to attack Microsoft licensing. It really isn't. It's hurt my business for a long, long time since we've had a business.
Yeah,
it really has.
Somebody in Wired could write the article like, this crazy stuff has been happening for 8 years.
Yeah. Well, right, because if they write about it like that, then they were clearly behind the times, and they are not a reliable source for relevant information. So, you know, they write about it like it's new.
I'm saying that they could write it as like the, you know, extended back of the magazine, 8-page long feature expose of terrible travesties of a particular industry.
Right. Well, the first page is just a giant title in 96-point font, and then it says continued on page 193.
All right, so what have I missed? I mean, while I've been, you know, the past 3 weeks or so kind of heads down on this book, you guys have been writing, so what's been going on?
Jack and I are working on a file or mobile data management argument.
For the last, like, 2.5 weeks, we've been, you know, covering seemingly nothing but mobile data management over at Consumerize IT. You know, there are several different conversations to be having. There's the personally created corporate information versus corporate created information argument. And there's the, if you manage the data, you don't have to manage the device argument. There's the, will any one of these companies ever become the de facto corporate Dropbox argument?
Or I loved Collins. We already have an enterprise version of Dropbox. It's called Dropbox.
Yeah.
and all the people, the commenters were arguing, Dropbox is not enterprise. It's not enterprise ready. It's a very dangerous thing. It's not safe, and you can steal the keys and all this kind of stuff.
This is the FUIT thing, man. It's there. Like, who gives a shit if they think it's not enterprise ready? It's already everywhere.
Oh, so money, because that's it. That's what I kind of say. Like, all of these conversations about whether Dropbox is secure are irrelevant, because all your shit is in Dropbox now anyway. So, like, all your stuff, I mean,
But for the user created shit, you know, that's whatever. We never had control of that stuff anyway. And you know, so the what people want is, I think, something from the other end, so that when the users are trying to access the corporate stuff, so that they don't have to bring it in Dropbox. If your company has, you know, whatever crappy solution that's not as robust as Dropbox, if you're at least making an effort of extending your corporate data in a way that it can be safely accessed on mobile devices, then that's a really big net, and you capture a lot of people that are would otherwise, yes, 100% be using Dropbox.
So you don't even have to get, like our company, for example. So we evaluated Box, and for our use case, Box was not as good as Dropbox.
Right. We didn't like it for our own personally created user information. But for the stuff that the reports that the company puts out, if they're putting it out on their official corporate Box, and Box is slower than Dropbox or something, who cares? At least there's a way for us to view it
on our devices,
without having to 100%. by having two different solutions?
Well, it's all complicated because there's Box that doesn't work for our use case, but it works for other people's use case in the organization. So now we actually have two solutions.
But we do have two solutions. We have our SMB file share going through our SSL VPN, and we have our Dropbox. And so I think Jack's point is
that... Yeah, and then we also have Box or whatever.
We don't have Box because we didn't go for it. But my point is that if they put in Box, they'd have to get rid of the SMB file shares and only use Box.
Or we go to something that like syncs the SMB file share or like rides on top of that.
Like a hyperdrive or res or whatever. But I think because the point is that right now, because all we have is this old school SMB file share, everyone in our office, even like the sales reps who are 22 years old, are all using Dropbox. Mm-hmm. And now the three of us, Gabe, Brian, Jack, and Justin, might continue to use Dropbox for the data we create. But if the company had Box, a lot of people would probably stop trying to find Dropbox. So I think the point is that it's like with app virtualization. You don't have to have a solution that works for 100% or is 100% as good as Dropbox, but you got to do something. Because if you just have SMB shares, then
you're 100% guaranteed
to have Dropbox for everyone.
And the fact that the thing for the corporate solution to aspire to is, hey, maybe that corporate Box someday is good enough that Gabe, you and I, and Brian and Justin, we all say, hey, you know what, like we might as well use that. But until then, the stuff that we create on our own and put in Dropbox, they never had control of anyway. So what's the big deal sort of? And I guess Gabe, this is an article that from Gabe that will be coming out tomorrow on CIT.
CIT is consumerized IT.
Right. That's our inside speak. So my whole question is, I guess it seems like people are waiting for this perfect solution. It will secure all the data on the mobile devices. And what the question I'm left with is, what's different now than what was there 3 or 4 or 50 years ago? I mean, because there's always been corporate data leaving the organization, and it's always been on some device or another. It's on laptops. It's in my briefcase. It's on my Handspring Trio from 2000.
But your Handspring Trio from 2000 only had like 8 megabytes of corporate data.
Well, so that's fine. But my briefcase was, you know, could be chock full of 2 reams of paper or something, right? My point here is that, and what this article is going to talk about, is the fact that this was we have a certain threshold that of pain that we're willing to endure because we've been enduring it. We're okay with that, right? We've got two types of data. We've got the data that we store under lock and key that you can't, you know, you go into this room and you know, if you're looking at it from a physical perspective, you go into a room, you're not allowed to copy it, you're not allowed to nothing. And then you've got the other data, the user created data that is essentially just insecure by default because somebody else created it and it's on another device. So I think that the solutions, we don't have to be, my point is that we don't have to be looking for the perfect solution that secures every piece of data and makes sure that every device is locked down perfectly because we can't trust the users to have this data on their device and all this crap. All we have to do is give them a way to access the data because they're going to find another way to do it anyway. And so if we give them some – or if there's some management capabilities on top of that, I think that's okay. All we're trying to do, I think, is get the risk down to what it was before everybody had an iPhone in their pocket and rather than trying to secure the living hell out of it.
So all we got to do is get that smoke back in that bottle and
– I don't think so. No. I'm saying the smoke is out and it will be out no matter what. And if like you said before, like if they have Box, like we got to give them something, right? Like –
We got to give them something for the corporate data because that's the way that they work. And if we don't give them something, then they'll treat it the way that they treat their personal data, the way that we treat our personal data. There just has to be a way no matter what. And this, I'll just loop this into another thing that I wrote that, you know, for like those 60% of companies or whatever. I don't know the exact number in our survey that we did a while ago that like haven't been accommodating this in any way at all. I say like the very, very first step that you take in your consumerization, BYOD, whatever strategy is to accommodate that corporate data on personal devices, even if it's just a mobile data management solution, because you can manage the devices all you want, but you'll get the very first step, you'll get more mileage out of providing that data in a safe way.
And so even if that data doesn't have to try to replace Dropbox across the board, if it's just the more this, the organization provides, the more likelihood that users are going to have stuff in there instead of bringing it into Dropbox.
Yeah, yeah.
It keeps honest people honest. Like, the rogues are still going to be the rogues. They're still going to, you know, if you want to, if you're about to quit the company and you want to export all of your client contacts and all of their information to a PDF and throw it up on Dropbox and share it with the whole world because you're pissed off, then fine, you're going to do that. Like, one way or another, that's going to happen.
We have case in point, Bradley Manning.
Okay. Who's that?
That's the, is that the name of the U.S. Army private?
Yeah, the guy that got all the stuff for WikiLeaks. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's, so the rogues are going to be the rogues. We're just trying to keep the honest people honest. And frankly, it's not a new problem. And that's the whole, my whole perspective is that it's just not, like, this is something we've been dealing with for a while. And there's an acceptable level of risk. And there always has been. And so we just need to keep that in mind, that we're not going to find, like, this white whale solution that fixes everything on mobile devices only.
Well, so we learned, so as the three of us had that conversation, this is a great analog for our consumerized IT website. As the three of us had that argument / conversation,
a whole other conversation was
happening. Everyone in the chat room continued to talk about what we were talking about for the first 45 minutes. And I feel like that way sometimes about consumerized IT. So maybe we'll make a separate show, a separate radio show that's just about the consumerization of IT. And that way we can focus just on the more sort of corporate desktop and application type stuff on the show. And then we'll do the consumerization stuff as a separate effort, because that's a big part of our lives. But it's something that maybe doesn't matter as much to everyone.
This has been one of the more active chat rooms, I think, that we've ever had. So this is a good topic. I think it brings people, it incites them.
I wish there was a way that we could include VDI.
Yeah, well, and all of security conversation here, because that's what most of this conversation is about, is how is this insecure versus this, and which one is better, and based on security alone. I mean, there's so many other reasons or ways that you can compare them as well, but it would be cool if there was a way to get the chat room into the conversation more. I mean, you know, because there's so much stuff going on, but we'd have to pause the show to go and read all of the conversation going on today.
Well, we're actually going through some stuff in our... We're sort of reorganizing our studio here a little bit. I don't know if we even told you that, Gabe, but I think we're gonna like get a big TV and put the chat room on in that, so we can at least like see it more easily. Anyway, I guess, you know, we're out of time for today, so let's wrap this up. I don't know if we have anyone has any final thoughts or anything you want to share, but anything from you, Guy?
No, thank you for having me, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it was great to finally talk to you in person. You know, we've seen snippets of your personality come through on Twitter, and so thank you for making.
We've been emailing for years, Brian. I've been arguing for years about desktops, haven't we? Really, when you think back to all the emails. It's
I didn't want to disclose all of that. Like, you know, there's definitely been emails from Guy. Like, are you fucking kidding me? This, you know, with like links. I have appreciated that, and in fact, Guy being on the show today, you know, is based on email exchange we had last week, and it's like, all right, we're bringing you on the show. So I thank you, Guy, for taking the time to join us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
And
nice to meet you.
All of you in the chat room, thank you so much for joining us today also. And so I guess from San Francisco, we're signing off. Gabe, thanks a lot, and we'll see you all next week.
Next week, yeah. Great. Adios.